From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
When Mazar-e Sharif city changed hands over the weekend, there were lots of looting and killing in the city. Our warehouse was looted with about 90 tons of food. What happened over the following 2 to 3 days, that our office was also looted, all computers, communication equipment, and furniture was taken.
Humanitarian organizations face looting and killing as they try to deliver aid to the poorest people of Afghanistan. The UN Security Council passes a resolution calling on states to contribute to a peacekeeping force. Today, a debate on UN involvement in the war-ravaged country and the Putin-Bush summit in Texas. Why would Putin agree to scrap the ABM treaty? Could it be because Russia will get to build one of its parts of the National Missile Defense Shield? All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Taliban forces continue to retreat in the face of massive U.S. bombing and advances by militia affiliated with the Northern Alliance. The Islamic militia appears to have lost control of Jalalabad in the east. A U.S. official in Washington, speaking on condition of anonymity, says there was fighting in the streets of Kandahar between Pashtun tribesmen and the Taliban, asserting the city would fall to anti-Taliban forces within days, if not hours. And south of Kandahar, once loyal Pashtun tribesmen and militia are reported to be revolting. Taliban fighters fleeing into the mountains to avoid U.S. airstrikes. U.S. jets continue to pound targets south of Jalalabad. Taliban officials have said their retreat is a tactical one and that they're prepared to wage a guerrilla war against Northern Alliance forces and against local militias and warlords in the southern part of the country that have emerged to once again challenge its rule. And the Pentagon announced it has more than 100 special forces operating in southern Afghanistan, helping to coordinate U.S. military action and looking for Osama bin Laden and Taliban leader Mullah Omar. The U.S. envoy for Afghanistan began talks with Pakistani officials today as the U.S. and U.N. attempt to build support for a transitional government in Afghanistan. The U.N. Special Representative for Afghanistan has called for a provisional council around which all ethnic, religious, and regional groups could rally. The council would set out terms for a transitional administration and a transitional period lasting no more than 2 years. The United Nations is also looking at sending a multinational force into Afghanistan, primarily to shadow the troops and commanders of the country's warlords and to monitor the actions of the Northern Alliance. However, the troops would not take any explicit role in controlling territory. The aim, UN officials say, would be at least to give the impression that the Afghans themselves are in charge of stabilizing their own land. The UN Security Council's negotiating last night on a new resolution giving broad but non-specific support to the deployment of foreign troops. The draft encourages governments to support efforts to ensure the safety and security of areas of Afghanistan no longer under Taliban control. The U.S. has taken a lead in these efforts, but its task is complicated by the fact that the Northern Alliance forces it backs have defied the U.S. by taking Kabul, has rejected the idea of an international force in Afghanistan, and has insisted that any talks about a future government take place in Kabul under Northern Alliance auspices. The first shipments of UN aid arrived in northern Afghanistan by river barge yesterday from neighboring Uzbekistan. If roads south to Mazar and beyond can now be secure, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and World Food Program intend to send tons of aid a month by this route. But UNHCR efforts have been complicated by the looting of its offices in Kabul and Mazar and the theft of tents, food, and other supplies meant for internally displaced people. 8 Western aid workers who'd been held by the Taliban since August were freed last night and airlifted out of Afghanistan in a U.S. military helicopter. The two Americans, two Australians, and four Germans were flown to Shaklali Air Base on the outskirts of Islamabad. They'd been working in Afghanistan for the German-based charity Shelter Now International when they were held on charges of attempting to convert Muslims to Christianity, a crime that carried the death penalty under the Taliban regime. Qatar's Al Jazeera satellite channel said its Washington correspondent, Mohammed Alami, was detained by police in Waco while covering the U.S.-Russian summit in Texas. Al-Alami said policemen armed with M16 automatic rifles followed him as he was leaving the airport and arrested him. Police said the foreign correspondent credit card had been used to purchase items outside the U.S. and in the past had been linked to Afghanistan. This move follows the U.S. bombing of the Al Jazeera network in Kabul. Al Jazeera is considered the CNN of the Arab world. And China may take part in an international peacekeeping effort in Afghanistan. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said China is ready to consider any effort that will contribute to stability and peace in Afghanistan. And finally, officials from the 142 countries in the World Trade Organization agreed yesterday on a plan for 3 years of negotiations aimed at lowering trade tariffs worldwide. The trade ministers effectively agreed to launch a new round of trade talks, but the main declaration issued was called the Doha Development Agenda in an attempt to satisfy developing countries. Officials from the developing countries were not pleased. The main declaration also includes a commitment to reduce tariffs that apply to goods such as textiles and clothing in which third world producers are most competitive. But the commitment is vague, and developing countries were disappointed they didn't get the immediate speed-up in tariff reductions on textiles and apparel that was envisioned in the Uruguay round. Edwin Starr, War, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When the Northern Alliance took Kabul, many thought that humanitarian aid could be immediately resumed into the poverty-stricken country. But the United Nations Children's Fund said yesterday it has suspended aid convoys to Afghanistan after fears that two drivers may have been killed in the northern city of Mazar-i-Sharif, which fell to the Northern Alliance on Friday. The drivers were ethnic Pashtun, and the city is dominated by other minorities. Mazar has a history of reprisal atrocities when it changes hands in Afghanistan's civil war. The UN World Food Program is reporting that there's pillaging in Mazar, as well as civilian kidnappings, armed men out of control, and fighting in the streets. The WFP says that 89 tons of food in UN warehouses has been stolen since the Northern Alliance took the city several days ago. And the fighting continues as Afghan opposition forces close in on the Taliban's headquarters in Kandahar. Warlords are grabbing huge chunks of territory, and the U.S. is continuing with airstrikes. And U.S. commandos are trying to block Osama bin Laden's possible escape routes. The Taliban has abandoned most key cities, but has vowed to wage a guerrilla war against U.S. and opposition forces. We're joined on the telephone right now by Khalid Mansour. He is a spokesperson for the World Food Program, and he is based in Islamabad. Khalid Mansour, can you tell us the situation right now in Mazar-i-Sharif?
When Mazar-i-Sharif city changed hands over the weekend, there were lots of looting and killing in the city. Our warehouse was looted with about 90 tons of food. What happened over the following 2 to 3 days, that our office was also looted, all computers, communication equipment, and furniture was taken. What we are trying to do now for Mazar-e-Sharif, we are bringing food from Uzbekistan across the river that makes the border with Afghanistan, and we are storing it on the border. Once conditions stabilize in Mazar, we will proceed with moving these food supplies to Mazar-e-Sharif. For the south, in Kandahar and Kabul areas, for the past 3 days, including today, truck drivers moving our food supplies are reluctant to go. They are afraid of insecurity. There are troop movements on the main roads, and roads are not safe proceeding to Kabul or Kandahar.
Who looted the office in Mazar?
To the best of our sketchy reporting from Mazar-e-Sharif, those were unidentified gunmen, some of them masked, and it happened during that twilight period of Taliban withdrawal, Northern Alliance takeover.
It sounds like, though, during the period of the Taliban in control, your warehouses and offices were not looted.
Well, what happened that the Taliban looted other warehouse in Kandahar itself a couple of weeks ago with 1,600 tons. The information coming out from Mazar-e-Sharif are very sketchy and unconfirmed. So we don't know the identity of the armed gunmen who went into the warehouse, but definitely it happened in the middle of the war between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance.
Have you heard anything about UNICEF and the workers that may have been, the drivers that may have been killed, leading UNICEF not to move back into Afghanistan right now?
I don't really have much to add to what UNICEF has already announced about one driver having been killed. I mean, all of us in the aid community are concerned about the safety of our aid workers on the ground, either in Mazar-e-Sharif or in Kabul. In the past few days, the Northern Alliance has provided armed security for our offices and warehouse in Kabul, and so far they have been intact, and we are actually reestablishing communication with them, communication that was cut off by the Taliban.
So what is the overall scope of the need right now, and how are you moving back in? How is the UN World Food Program?
The World Food Program has already returned international staff to Faizabad in northeast Afghanistan. What we are going to do over the coming few days is to return international staff to Kabul and hopefully to Mazar soon enough to resume full normal operation in the country that was disrupted over the past few weeks. What we really need from all the factions and on the ground to reestablish law and order fast. We were able in the first 13 to 14 days of November to bring 30,000 tons of food into Afghanistan. But over the last 3 days, we brought in a trickle of food, just a few hundred tons. It's very important now, very vital for us, especially with areas that will be blocked by snow, to have not only a normal access, but to have really an enhanced and stepped up access to these areas so we can pre-position all the foods to these areas and provide food also to the hundreds of thousands of people that have been cut off for a few weeks so far.
What about in the south, though, where it sounds like the U.S. is still bombing?
Well, in the south, as a matter of fact, we are more concerned about the north because this is the most drought-affected area, and there we have more than 3 million people who are in need of immediate food aid. People in the south happen to have more food stocks from their harvest that was better than the north. We want to go back to the south as soon as possible. We have not been in Kandahar since mid-September when the Taliban took over our office, and we want to go back to Kabul. But we have stocks in Kabul that can maintain our operation. What we need to do is to reopen the road because our trucks go beyond Kabul to the central highland. This is a mountainous terrain that will be blocked off by snow latest by late December. So we need to position about 16,000 tons of food there. So we are in a race with time, and it will help us a lot if the roads to Kabul will be open and safe as soon as possible. I think the most important for us is to bring stability and security to the main roads There are hundreds of thousands of people in districts that have been cut off because of bandit activity, because of moving front lines. Now that the front lines are all pushed to the south, we really need to stabilize this country fast.
Khalid Mansour, spokesperson for the World Food Program in Islamabad, speaking to us about the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. And you are listening to the War and Peace Report as we move now to what a new government of Afghanistan would look like. The United Nations Security Council yesterday voted unanimously for a resolution encouraging member states to provide military and other support for security arrangements in areas no longer controlled by the Taliban militia. The UN top Afghan envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, had previously resisted sending foreign troops into Afghanistan. But he now says that the dramatic collapse of Taliban rule means there's no time to arrange an Afghan security force, and international troops would be needed to protect the new administration. Diplomats at the UN say the bulk of the force would have to be Muslim to avoid the appearance that Afghanistan is being colonized by the West. The U.S. Secretary of State, General Colin Powell, says Turkey, Bangladesh, and Indonesia have offered troops for a multinational force. Just after East Timor's historic vote for independence from Indonesia in 1999, the Indonesian military killed thousands of Timorese, burnt three-fourths of the infrastructure to the ground. The Indonesian military is also well known for its killing of thousands of civilians in Aceh and repression in West Papua. The UN plans could come into conflict with the Northern Alliance, which took Kabul this week in defiance of U.S. warnings not to enter the city. The alliance's foreign minister says any effort to build an interim administration should convene under alliance auspices in Kabul. The Northern Alliance also says the former Afghan king, Mohammad Zahir Shah, whom the U.S. favors as the head of the new government, can return to Afghanistan only as a private citizen. Meanwhile, the Security Council seems to have made no effort to include Afghan women in the building of the future government of Afghanistan. We're going to start off with Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and author of the book Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. Phyllis Bennis, how unusual is it for the UN Security Council to vote unanimously for the UN peacekeeping force to be moving in now to Afghanistan? And what do we expect of UN involvement in the actually establishing an Afghan government?
You know, Amy, the votes on everything relating to the aftermath of the September 11th events have been taken unanimously in the Security Council. From the initial vote, which was simply a condemnation, although it was later used by the U.S. to claim it was a justification for U.S. military action, to the resolution on the question of shutting down finances for the terrorist organizations worldwide, all of these resolutions have been passed unanimously. So that has become essentially habitual in this moment when everything the U.S. wants is being adopted with very little dissent. Now, the distinction here is that this was not a vote to send U.S. troops. Lakhdar Brahimi, as you mentioned, had been resisting the idea of sending international troops, hoping that an internal Afghan police force could be put in place in time. It became clear that that was not possible, and this vote was not to send U.N. blue helmets under U.N. auspices because of the fear that it would take too long. Instead, it calls more generally for what is known as a coalition of the willing, meaning those governments willing to send their troops would do so, and it's not at all clear whether those troops would then be working under U.N. auspices or not. The proposal from Lakhdar Brahimi that he had put forward to the Security Council the day before yesterday was a much more all-sided proposal dealing with the question of how the U.N. can help support Afghans in the effort to recraft a governance structure for the country. And it involved the convening in five stages of meetings that were designed to bring together a very broad range of Afghan civil society. In fact, there's a reference in Brahimi's proposal that says the credibility and legitimacy of the Provisional Council would be enhanced if particular attention was given to the participation of individuals and groups, including women, who have not been engaged in armed conflict. The fear, of course, is that the proposal will result in the creation of a government made up of a wide range of militia leaders, a wide range of warlords, essentially, and there's a great deal of fear that that wouldn't look qualitatively different than that of the Taliban. Afghanistan has been plagued for 20 years by this kind of antagonism between militia-run organizations, and the involvement of women and people who have not been involved in the military side is seen as crucial for breaking that pattern. But it's a very dicey proposition. We know from history that the U.S. in particular has been averse to many efforts by the United Nations to craft this kind of creative and non-military approach to what is known as peace building. When the UN tried in Somalia almost a decade ago in a similar situation of severe famine, the end of a war, the abandonment by Cold War powers, leaving behind only their weapons, and the complete collapse of central government, the UN, under its special envoy at that time, Mohamed Sahnoun, an Algerian former diplomat, put together a very creative proposal that would have involved trying to rebuild government structures from the bottom up at the local level first, trying to co-opt the militias rather than forcibly disarm them with all of the instability that that would cause. It looked like it might have a chance to work, but it was clearly going to take a long time and would not be very visible and dramatic. Washington essentially decided they wanted quick and they wanted telegenic, and they orchestrated an end to Sahnoun's plan. Sahnoun he finished his term early, and the UN began the process of militarization, which led to then the participation not under UN auspices of the U.S. troops, which led, of course, as we know, to the disaster in Somalia of 1993.
Phyllis, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Phyllis Benn is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. When we come back, we will also be joined by Sonali Kolhatkar, who is with the Afghan Women's Mission, to talk about what role Afghan women will play in the establishing of a new government, and Joel Charney, who is with Refugees International and has just returned from Pakistan. Stay with us.
Got my hair, got my head, got my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got my smile. I got my tongue, got my chin, got my neck, got my boots, got my heart, got my soul, got my back, I got my sick. I got my arms, got my hands, got my fingers, got my legs, got my feet, got my toes, got my liver, got my blood, I've got life.
Got no, I got life. Nina Simone here on the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about what will the new government of Afghanistan look like. Our guest, Phyllis Benn, who has been studying and reporting on the United Nations for many years. Her book is called Who Calls the Shots? Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. Also, Sonali Kolhatkar, spokesperson for Afghan Women's Mission, and Joel Charney, who is the vice president for policy at Refugees International. Sonali Kolhatkar, you have been traveling around with RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, talking about the future of Afghanistan, also condemning the U.S. bombing. What role are Afghan women playing right now as the Northern Alliance take over Kabul and a new government seems to be in the offing?
Well, it's actually not very clear that they're going, that right now as we speak, that they're playing much of a role, although obviously the desire is there. Recently there was a press conference that members of RAWA convened with a local Pakistani members of the Human Rights Commission, such as Asma Jahangir, and some members of the female members of the European Parliament, Louisa Morgantini, I believe. This convened in Pakistan about a week ago, in which they very clearly urged for a role for the United Nations in an interim government in Afghanistan, and also clearly condemned the bombing and talked about wanting peace. And these are the kinds of ways in which women have been sort of trying to raise their voices, women like the women of RAWA, but very little is actually being done on a practical level. I know that some representatives of RAWA met Lakhdar Brahimi recently, but of course right now things are changing so fast that it's almost, it's going to be a Herculean task to really ensure that women get included in the government. I mean, who are they going to appeal to? Are they going to appeal to the United States, to the United Nations, to the Northern Alliance? The women of RAWA have been appealing to the United Nations for years, since 1996 when the Taliban first took over. And RAWA just recently released a statement where they again reiterated that that the United Nations has to play a role and that peacekeeping troops have to come in, disarm the fundamentalists, and that at some level, the only people that the people of Afghanistan will trust today are the United Nations. They will not trust a foreign domination. They will not trust U.S. troops, and then they will not accept them. And RAWA has also called very, very seriously for the Northern Alliance to be discredited because, according to them, they're war criminals. And they have called for the United Nations to withdraw its recognition because, of course, Rabbani, who is part of the Northern Alliance, is still a recognized president of Afghanistan. But this man, along with the commanders underneath him, have a history of human rights violations, have a history of violations against women. Even if women were included in a coalition government in Afghanistan, how could they possibly serve alongside men who are basically war criminals? So RAWA has called for the UN to withdraw its recognition and of this establishment, of this corrupt and terrorist and criminal establishment, and asked the UN to send peacekeeping forces into the country before the Northern Alliance can repeat the kinds of crimes they committed during the civil war in the early 90s. And according to RAWA, this is what the majority of the Afghan people want. So in terms of actually calling for women being a part of a coalition government, we have to question what this coalition government itself is going to be composed of.
Sonali, I'm looking at the front page of the New York Times, which has a picture of two women smiling, their faces uncovered. And then inside in their special daily edition, A Nation Challenged, is a picture of women with their with the purdah, the burqas off. And they are washing clothes. It says Afghan women were washing clothes in Kabul River yesterday under Taliban rule. They were forbidden to work or study and forced to cover themselves head to toe. So the message being put out now is that the Northern Alliance is liberating the women of Afghanistan. What did women look like under Northern Alliance rule? And is this going to be representative of what they can do from now on?
Well, it's very, it was very predictable that they were going to have this kind of propaganda. I mean, showing women taking their veils off. Undoubtedly, Afghans are happy that the Taliban are gone. Undoubtedly, Afghan women are relieved that they can walk around in the streets, take off their burqas, men can shave their beards. This is definitely something that Afghan people want. But at some level, we have to examine how much PR this is playing into this, because the international world, the international community is, of course, looking very closely at what is going on. And the Northern Alliance realizes very clearly that the issue of women's rights is one yardstick that they have been measured by. And so they realize that they have to really play it safe. They have to allow all of this to take place. But if you look back just a few weeks ago, in territory under the Northern Alliance, women were living lives that were almost the same as the lives they were living under the Taliban. There were a few token gestures. 8 women were allowed for the first time to go to university along 300 men, even though this territory had been controlled by the Northern Alliance for years. Women were still completely covering themselves. They were saying, well, it's not the law. But, of course, the societal pressure in those territories was so great that most women didn't uncover themselves. The article in the New York Times that described this started out saying that women can ride in the backs of trucks if a man lets them in this part of Afghanistan. You know, they can talk to shopkeepers only if absolutely necessary. You know, the range of vocations available to them were midwife or cleaning lady. You know, very similar to the life under the Taliban, better maybe only in token gestures, but for the vast majority of Afghan women, still vastly different from the life they enjoyed a couple of decades ago. So I am not at all optimistic, and I know the women of Rawah have been denouncing the Northern Alliance for years, saying, do not trust these men. They are not legitimate in the eyes of the Afghan people.
Sonali Kolkhadhar is a spokesperson for the Afghan Women's Mission, which is working closely with the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She's speaking to us from California. Joel Charney is vice president for policy at Refugees International, which is a Washington-based advocacy group that describes itself as a voice for humanitarian action. You're going to be testifying before the Senate today on behalf of Refugees International. Tell us what you're calling for.
Well, our focus is less on the future political dispensation on Afghanistan, which is obviously critical, and more on the issues that you were discussing with Khaled Mansour of WFP. Basically, the military advances of the Northern Alliance theoretically open up the part of the country that's most in need of emergency assistance, with approximately 75% to 80% of the vulnerable people in Afghanistan living in that northern tier of the country that's been experiencing drought and, of course, the consequences of the conflict. So what we're focusing on in our testimony today are three things in particular. One, getting the friendship bridge open between Uzbekistan and northern Afghanistan. Two, and the second thing does relate to our discussion this morning. The second thing is we need to find a way to establish law and order in Afghanistan as rapidly as possible. And it really begs the question of what mechanisms are available to the international community to do so. You know, should this be, we're calling basically for some kind of police force to enforce law and order in the towns, Mazar-e-Sharif, in Kabul, if necessary, and Herat, perhaps, again, simply to create enough stability so that the relief effort can go forward. Now, as we've been discussing this morning, that begs the question of, you know, who is going to supply these, you know, these police or military personnel, under whose auspices are they going to go in, and so on. And it is extremely complex. There are no easy solutions absent a standing capacity that would be available to the international community, which doesn't exist at this point. Then finally, we're calling for an increase in funding to non-governmental organizations so that they can, you know, fill the humanitarian space as it opens up.
The Congress, there are a lot of right-wing Republicans who see the UN as the enemy of the United States, talk about it as the world government that they have tried to defund for many years. What is the response right now? You're about to testify in the Senate.
Well, it's a whole new world after September 11th. I'm sure your listeners appreciate the irony of an administration, you know, composed of people who campaigned against nation building, campaigned, you know, against the United Nations, now being forced by circumstances to, in essence, look to the UN to provide stability. I mean, in fairness to the Bush administration, I don't know about, you know, right-wing Republicans on the Hill, but, I mean, in fairness to the Bush administration, they are certainly, they're trying to learn on the fly and are paying lip service, at least, to you know, the fact that, no, we can't have U.S. troops occupying Afghanistan. Yes, we want to support the political process that Brahimi is attempting to put together. Yes, we may need some kind of multinational peacekeeping force, ideally led by troops from Muslim nations. Although, as you mentioned, I wouldn't feel too sanguine with Indonesians running around as peacekeepers, given the human rights record of the Indonesian army in their own country. But nonetheless, it's a difficult situation where, at least from the administration, we're getting messages that I don't think anyone would have predicted, say, 6 months ago, if such a major crisis had been anticipated.
Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, would you like to add to that?
Well, I think that Joel is right that we are hearing lip service in favor of more significant United Nations involvement. I think it's reflecting, on the one hand, the changed circumstances, as he said, but also we have to keep in mind this is lip service. We don't know how far this is going to go. The key question, I think, that will give us a better indication of where the administration really stands is the position they take vis-a-vis the Brahimi report. Will they try to tinker with it? Will they try to micromanage it? Very crucially, will they try, for example, recognizing that they have an advantage of not sending U.S. troops to be part of any kind of international force in Afghanistan beyond the special operations people who are already there, the Delta Force and others who are already on the ground. We're not sure what they're doing. We just know that they're there. The U.S. may have the position of saying we want the commander of this force, even though they will not be ground troops from the U.S. Our contribution will be we'll provide a better trained commander, which would essentially provide a grouping of third world soldiers from Muslim nations under U.S. or allied command in some way. And I think that's something we have to be very wary of. This goes to the fundamental question of whether the U.S. is serious about recognizing this as an international crisis. There was a lot of talk at the time of September 11th that this was an international event, which I happen to agree with. I think it was an international crime which required an international response. The question is, how does international response get defined? Is it really going to allow the United Nations to make decisions and create the necessary tools to carry them out with the support of the United States, financial and political, or are we going to be faced with a scenario where the U.S. uses the lip service of multilateralism, the United Nations, and international approaches in service of what is essentially lateral force?
Yeah, I think if I could just add, I mean, the UN, at least Brahimi and Kofi Annan himself, have made it very clear that they're not going to get themselves in an impossible situation again. You know, thinking precisely of Somalia and the debacle there, you know, the failed UN peacekeeping mission in Sierra Leone. I'm pretty sure, at least from the UN side, they understand that if there's no peace to keep, they're not going to send peacekeepers. And that's why I think expectations have to be realistic about what the role of the UN can and should be. I mean, I would certainly support, you know, a UN operation, you know, that's actually managed and directed by the United Nations. I think that has the possibility of being a credible operation in the eyes of the Afghan people. But whether the conditions on the ground will be conducive to such a mission, I think is very much up in the air. And, you know, the Afghan people, to the extent that they have expectations of the UN, I think need to temper those expectations. I mean, the UN cannot come in under current circumstances and, you know, disarm warlords. The UN will simply not do that, and Kofi Annan and Lakhdar Brahimi have made that clear since mid-September.
The head of your organization, Refugees International, Joel Charney, is the former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Clinton Ken Bacon. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's right. Sonali Kolhatkar, spokesperson for Afghan Women's Mission, we're going to end with you, and I just want to go back to the record of the Northern Alliance as we see what could possibly happen in Afghanistan or what won't happen. Looking at the RAWA website, it says, yesterday the pictures from Kabul were almost identical to the videotapes of April 1992 when the pro-Russians and communists were defeated. We saw the same jubilation by the non-Pashto population, and within 2 days, Hekmatyar Gulbedin began to bomb the city. The division of ethnic groups plunged the Afghan capital into civil war. Yesterday, the alliance was supposed to wait on the outskirts of the city while the Americans attempted to construct a workable solution, but for the present, Afghanistan without the Taliban is a country without a government. Can you talk about what happened in 1992? We've heard references to there were atrocities, etc., but RAWA has emphasized what has happened under that group that was in power, that is the Northern Alliance today.
Yes, the what happened in the early 90s was that there were seven political parties that had billions of dollars of weapons and training that had defeated, in their eyes, the Russians, driven them out. And in the early 90s, we're still being paid something like $700 million a year by the United States in weapons and military training. In fact, in the early 90s, after the Gulf War, we recently found out that the United States took confiscated weapons from Iraqis and gave them as a parting gift to the groups that now comprise the Northern Alliance, you know, just constantly pouring weapons and weapons into the hands of these people. Very predictably, when the puppet regime installed by the Russian, the Najibullah government, was toppled, very predictably, these seven political parties, these mujahideen, turned upon one another in a struggle for power and started the so-called civil war. I don't even like that word, civil war, because it was simply a power struggle between armed fundamentalist groups. And what they did was they turned upon cities like Kabul, where 90% of their targets were non-military. 90%. I mean, this was really the reign of terror. And they fought one another, rocket shelling the city. 45,000 Afghans were killed in Kabul alone between the years 1992 to 1996. This was also the period that the conflict in Afghanistan was completely underreported by the media, the Western media. And this was the time when people were paying attention in the international community to the atrocities in Sarajevo. Recently, those atrocities in Sarajevo have been called a sideshow in comparison to what was happening in Kabul. And, of course, women were the first victims, as usual. They experienced mass rapes and forced marriages and abductions. They committed suicide on a large scale. And this really was the most brutal, most bloody era for Afghans. Into the political vacuum in the chaos of 1996 stepped in the Taliban. So the chaos of the early 90s was committed by the men who then regrouped very quickly to form the Northern Alliance and fled to the north. These are the same men. There's nothing different about them. They have not changed their views. Ideologically, they're the same. They're now being supported, ironically, by Russia, who was their once enemy, and by China, by India, and of course the United States. And I actually don't believe this theory that they were forced to wait and the United States urged them to wait. It was so predictable. When you drive the Taliban out with bombs from Kabul, you don't expect their arch opposition. You don't think that they're actually going to sit by idly and obediently and wait. Of course they were going to go and fill in the vacuum left behind by the Taliban. Of course there was going to be this occupation of Kabul. So I don't buy that. And now again, the Afghan people are suffering, and they're literally terrified of what's to come once the international community looks away.
Sonali Kolhatkar, thanks very much for being with us, spokesperson for the Afghan Women's Mission, working with the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, RAWA. Joel Charney with us from Refugees International. He's vice president for policy in Washington, going to testify before the Senate. And Phyllis Bennis, author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. And all their information is on our website, contact information at democracynow.org. It's just been launched. Jackie Suin is our webmeister, and we hope that you go to it. You can also listen to us online there, as well as get videotapes of people like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we return, we're going to talk about President Bush meeting with Vladimir Putin in Texas. What is this U.S.-Russian relationship and the scrapping of the ABM treaty? Stay with us.
Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
Masters of War, Bob Dylan, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Refugee Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin are in Crawford, Texas today, where Bush is attempting to convince Putin to allow the U.S. to abandon the anti-ballistic missile treaty so we can move forward with missile defense. Bush announced at a joint press conference Tuesday he's going to cut the U.S. nuclear arsenal by two-thirds to around 2,000 weapons within the next decade. Bush said, quote, "I looked Putin in the eye and shook his hand, and if we need to write it down on a piece of paper, I'll be glad to do that." Russian Foreign Minister Ivanov said, yes, putting an agreement on nuclear weapons in writing would be nice. Later in remarks broadcast on Moscow television from Washington, Putin announced a similar cut in Russia's long-range nuclear arsenal to about a third of its present size. However, there was still no sign of the Russians agreeing to a deal that would allow the U.S. an easy way out of the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty so Bush can go ahead with his scheme for missile defense. The Bush-Putin talks come as Russia and other countries in Central Asia scramble for position in determining the makeup of an interim government in Afghanistan, a process the U.S. said it is determined to control. We turn now to David Kotz. He's co-author of Revolution from Above, The Demise of the Soviet System, and a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Can you talk about the significance of this meeting that Bush and Putin are having now in Texas?
Well, there clearly is a major turn in U.S.-Russian relations, at least at the moment. After some period of rather frosty relations, President Putin has decided to try to move close to the U.S. administration. It certainly could be a good thing to have tensions reduced between the United States and Russia with all those nuclear weapons, and it is encouraging to see promises of reduction in nuclear weapons on hand. But there are real risks in the way in which the two governments are coming together. One of the risks is that by coming together around this so-called war on terrorism, it unfortunately will only tend to reinforce the view of many in the world that this is a war against Islam, since the new agreement includes, evidently, the U.S. government ending its criticism of Russia's military tactics against Muslim Chechnya. And, of course, Russia has a long history of conflict with Islamic groups in past times.
Can you talk about that record? Can you talk about what's happening in Chechnya now? And with Putin a part of the, quote, war on terrorism, would you describe what's happening in Chechnya, what the Russian troops are doing as terrorism?
Well, it's really a very sad story. This latest phase of Russian involvement in Chechnya began just 2 years ago when, after several years of de facto independence for the tiny republic, as it's called, of Chechnya, still within the Russian Federation, but it was effectively independent, it produced chaos and lawlessness, kidnapping. And by 1999, much of the Chechen population was ready to welcome a reassertion of Russian authority over Chechnya, which had been part of the Soviet Union and before that the Russian Empire since the mid-19th century. But the way the Russian military went into Chechnya in 1999, behind massive artillery barrages, leveling much of the capital city of Grozny and killing large numbers of people, the famous collateral damage, as it's called, has, from all reports, completely alienated the Chechen people, and people, many of whom had been ready to welcome return to the Russian Federation. Now Russia is going to be stuck stationing a large military force there indefinitely if it hopes to keep Chechnya as part of Russia. They're facing constant ambushes and so forth. There is a lesson for the United States. There was great sympathy throughout the world following September 11th for the U.S. and significant potential support out there for an appropriate coalition action to find the people who did the September 11th attacks and prevent further attacks. But I'm afraid, following the path of Russia and Chechnya, our government launching airstrikes on one of the poorest countries in the world has caused a lot of collateral damage and may have dissipated much of this goodwill.
We're talking to David Kotz, co-author of Revolution from Above, The Demise of the Soviet System, as Putin and Bush meet in Crawford, Texas. What about the domestic support or opposition for the bombing of Afghanistan within Russia? And how does this compare to the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia? I mean, you had Clinton in a very different position with Russia than we see with Bush and Putin today.
Well, the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia still has its echoes in Russia, because of the long-standing close relations between the Russians and the people of Yugoslavia. The U.S.-led NATO bombing produced probably the strongest popular anti-American feeling in Russia within the last century. And this is not evaporated. There is also significant doubt and opposition within the Russian elite about the new proposed close relationship between the Russian and American governments. There's even, you know, been talk of Russia supplying military, some components for the U.S. Anti-ballistic missile system that Bush wants to build. There is a lot of concern within the Russian elite. This could make Putin's position difficult, and it's not clear how stable this new close relationship will be. And, I know it sounds unbelievable, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but this has been reported in the media as Bush is trying to find a way to get the Russians to drop their opposition to departing from the ABM treaty. This has been proposed as a possible sweetener for Russia to let their declining military industry, military goods industry, produce some components. There hasn't been an agreement, but this has been mentioned.
Well, it's become pretty straightforward then. The axes of alliance are completely shifting from east to west, to the east and the west joining together, at least Russia and the United States versus the South.
Yes, you know, it's not good to have the United States and Russia in a tense standoff, but it can also be problematic if they develop an alliance that seems directed at large parts of the rest of the world. That will have its own enormous problems.
I want to ask you a question about Russia not being in the WTO, though China has just entered it at the Qatar meeting. But first, the whole issue of the U.S. in the Central Asian republics and the CARs, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and the cementing of the relationship. What does this mean for Russia?
Well, this is part of the division within Russia. As the United States began setting up basing agreements with some of these republics, with Uzbekistan, and trying to do so in a few of the others, Kyrgyzstan. Some Russian analysts were very worried that the United States was going to really be right on Russia's doorstep with military force. But Putin decided to support this, and I guess it was kind of a choice. They felt either we're really going to be surrounded or we better join them. So at the moment, Putin has turned this into an attempt to build a strategic alliance with the United States. That's one of the major things Putin can offer, is basing rights near Afghanistan, in addition to intelligence from Russia's long war in Afghanistan. And both of those have been provided, apparently.
Finally, China entering the WTO along with Taiwan and Qatar, yet Russia is the Russia is the only industrialized country not yet in the WTO. Why is this?
Well, Russia only recently emerged from the Soviet Union 10 years ago, and the WTO does have some fairly strict rules about trade policies and investment policies. It does take time for a country that has just recently adopted a market-type system to gain admission. Russia would very much like to join, and this is also on the table in these negotiations, namely U.S. support for Russia joining sooner rather than later. But Russia would certainly have a long way to go in the area of clear rules about trade and investment. It is still a system in which there's a lot of arbitrary power exercised in that area.
David Kotz, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of Revolution from Above, The Demise of the Soviet System. That does it for today's program. This weekend, I look forward to seeing listeners at WRPI on Friday night at 7 o'clock at Chapel and Cultural Center in Troy, 2125 Burdett Avenue, speaking about the War and Peace Report. That's Friday night in Troy, New York, WRPI. And then on Saturday night, I'll be at All Souls Church at 16th and Columbia in Washington, D.C. from 6 to 9. As we discuss Pacifica Radio, there will be a national board meeting this weekend, and all are encouraged to come. Pacifica is supposed to be a democratic network and should be open to all people's comment. That's in Washington, D.C., Saturday night, a discussion of our network and free speech radio at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. And if you'd like to order, if you'd like to get more information on videotapes of Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Faridi Sak, a discussion with the Muslim liberation theologian, you can call 1-800-926-3921, 1-800-926-3921. Go to our website. You'll see all the contacts for all of our guests, as well as information about the videotapes at democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Salone is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where we are live streaming. You can also hear us at webactive.com. We're broadcasting on channels 34 and 56 on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, on CUNY Television, and on Dish TV, channel 9415. That's Free Speech TV. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. From Ground Zero Radio, this is the War and Peace Report. As the Dominican community mourns losses from the crash of American Airlines Flight 587 in Queens, New York, many family members of undocumented immigrants are afraid to claim their dead or leave the country to bury them. In this time of crackdown on immigrant Arab South Asian communities in the United States, actor Peter Coyote talks about knowing your rights. And as anti-terrorism legislation and fear of dissent sweep the country, one organizer talks about racial profiling and speaking out against war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, broadcasting from a firehouse outside of which is a continued police checkpoint where the Army, National Guard, and police check vans and cars and trucks that pass by. I'm Amy Goodman. Taliban forces continue to retreat in the face of massive U.S. bombing and advances by militia affiliated with the Northern Alliance. The Islamic militia appears to have lost control of Jalalabad in the east. A U.S. official in Washington, speaking on condition of anonymity, said there's fighting in the streets of Kandahar between Pashtun tribesmen and the Taliban, asserting that the city would fall to anti-Taliban forces within days, if not hours. And south of Kandahar, once loyal Pashtun tribesmen and militias are reported to be revolting and Taliban fighters fleeing into the mountains to avoid U.S. airstrikes. U.S. jets continue to pound targets south of Jalalabad. Taliban officials have said their retreat is a tactical one and that they're prepared to wage a guerrilla war against Northern Alliance forces and against local militias and warlords in the southern part of the country that have emerged to once again challenge its rule. And the Pentagon announced as more than 100 special forces operating in southern Afghanistan, helping to coordinate U.S. military action and looking for Osama bin Laden and Taliban leader Mullah Omar. The U.S. envoy for Afghanistan began talks with Pakistani officials today as the U.S. and U.N. attempt to build support for a transitional government in Afghanistan. The U.N. Special Representative for Afghanistan has called for a provisional council around which all ethnic, religious, and regional groups could rally. The council would set out terms for a transitional administration and a transitional period lasting no more than 2 years. The UN Security Council passed a unanimous resolution last night giving support to the deployment of foreign troops in Afghanistan. The first shipments of United Nations aid arrived in northern Afghanistan by river barge yesterday from neighboring Uzbekistan. But the United Nations Children's Fund said it had suspended aid convoys to Afghanistan after fears that two drivers may have been killed in the northern city of Mazar-e Sharif, which fell to the Northern Alliance on Friday. The drivers were ethnic Pashtun, and the city is dominated by other minorities. Mazar has a history of reprisal atrocities, which, when it changes hands in Afghanistan's civil war. The World Food Program is reporting that there is pillaging in Mazar, as well as civilian kidnappings, armed men out of control, and fighting in the streets. The WFP says close to 90 tons of food in UN warehouses has been stolen since the Northern Alliance took the city several days ago. China does not rule out sending peacekeepers to Afghanistan. It may take part in an international peacekeeping effort there. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said China is ready to consider any effort that will contribute to stability and peace in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Chinese authorities on Sunday sentenced a group of 21 from the Muslim-majority region of Xinjiang at a public rally. Two people were given death sentences and immediately executed, while others were given prison terms of up to 20 years. Police claim those put to death were ordinary criminals convicted of murder and armed robbery, but a group representing the ethnic Uyghur population of Xinjiang said all of those executed and given suspended death sentences were independence activists. Rights groups have warned that China is carrying out a major crackdown on religious and political dissent in Xinjiang under the guise of anti-terrorism following September 11th. Officials from the 142 countries in the World Trade Organization agreed yesterday on a plan for 3 years of negotiations aimed at lowering trade tariffs worldwide. The trade ministers effectively agreed to launch a new round of trade talks, but the main declaration issued was called the Doha Development Agenda in an attempt to satisfy developing countries. Officials from these countries were not pleased. The main declaration also includes a commitment to reduce tariffs that apply to goods such as textiles, in which third world producers are most competitive. But the commitment is vague, and developing countries are disappointed that they didn't get the immediate speed up in tariff reductions on textiles and apparel that was envisioned in the Uruguay round. 8 Western aid workers who'd been held by the Taliban since August were freed last night, airlifted out of Afghanistan in a U.S. military helicopter. 2 Americans, 2 Australians, 4 Germans were flown to Shakhlali Air Base on the outskirts of Islamabad. They've been working in Afghanistan for the German-based charity Shelter Now International when they were held on charges of attempting to convert Muslims to Christianity, a crime that carried the death penalty under the Taliban regime. And the American Red Cross says it will use all of the more than $500 million donated to its so-called Liberty Fund for people affected by the September 11th attacks. The Red Cross came under harsh criticism after it announced it would divert more than $200 million in donations to its own institutional needs, forcing the resignation of the organization's president. Critics charge the Red Cross intentionally misled donors into thinking all the money they donated would go to victims. The Red Cross has also come under fire after it revealed it would have to destroy tens of thousands of pints of blood it collected after September 11th, even though it knew already it had enough blood to meet its needs. And Senate Republicans managed yesterday to block a $73 billion Democratic stimulus package that they said contained too few tax cuts. The Democratic legislation is focused on an aid to the jobless and included a 10-year, $15 billion package of Homeland Security measures. House Republican leaders and President Bush continue to push for a $100 billion plan overwhelmingly weighted toward tax cuts for the wealthy and tax rebates for some of the nation's largest corporations. Aretha Franklin singing the Marvin Gaye composition, Holy, Holy, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Almost 90% of the 265 people who died on Monday in the crash of the American Airlines Flight 587 jetliner bound for Santo Domingo were of Dominican origin. The Dominican consul, his eyes red from grieving, said there's no break for the Dominicans. We'd hardly begun to recover from the shock of the September 11th tragedy, and now this happens. New York's Washington Heights neighborhood is home to the nation's largest concentration of Dominican immigrants. Piles of flowers in memory of the dead dot the sidewalks of the deeply religious working-class neighborhood. Outside the office of Alianza Dominicana, a social service agency, is a makeshift memorial marked by candles, flowers, and a banner that reads, Estamos de luto, or we are in mourning. Yesterday, as some family members of victims gathered to seek counseling, New York Police Department buses transported many to a family assistance center to supply DNA evidence to help identify remains. But amid the community's grief, Dominican relatives of some of the victims of the American Airlines flight are afraid to come forward to claim the bodies of their loved ones or to leave the country to bury them. Family members and community leaders are calling on the federal government to grant an amnesty so that those in the United States illegally can regain entry into the country if they return to the Dominican Republic to bury their dead. The fear of deportation for the immigrant community is very strong. Kimberly Weissman, a spokesperson for the Immigration Naturalization Service, said the INS is urging undocumented immigrants who lost loved ones to contact authorities without fear of being detained or deported, as was also the case following the attack on the World Trade Center. But she said she was unsure whether those without papers would be allowed to re-enter the country if they go to bury their loved ones abroad. Senator Charles Schumer, the New York Democrat, says he's worked out an agreement with the U.S. Embassy in Santo Domingo to expedite visas for family members wishing to come to the United States. We go now to Ruben Diaz. He's a New York State Assembly member for the Bronx and one of the outspoken advocates of New York's Dominican community. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
It's very good to have you with us. Well, first of all, can you lay out for us the scope of the tragedy that your community is now facing?
Well, this is something that has never been faced here in the United States by the Dominican community, and it makes it even much more tragic when we just got over the and we're not completely over the World Trade Center bombing. Just 2 months later, we have this horrific event now, where not only those people who were passengers on the flight of 587, but also the residents of Bell Harbor and the Far Rockaway section of New York City have suffered this impact as well. And let me tell you something, that, again, New York City and New Yorkers have come together, just like the World Trade Center bombing, and like in many other dark moments of the city of New York, we've come together. People are pulling together. I mean, I'm not Dominican. My father and I are Puerto Ricans, and my father, who's the Reverend Ruben Diaz and the president of the Hispanic Clergy Organization, we have come together and supported the Dominican community, because the Dominican community has always been there for the Puerto Rican community and for other communities. Many of the heroes that we commemorate and that we applaud during the WTC bombing were Dominicans, and so now it's time for us to stand by this community. Unfortunately, there are so many peripheral issues that we have to deal with, and one of them is the fact that many of the family members who are here illegally are somewhat scared, not only to just come in and to claim their loss and their loved ones, but also to go out and fly to the Dominican Republic. And so yesterday, along with my father, Reverend Diaz, along with Fernando Mateo, I had a press conference calling for the federal government to grant these family members emergency amnesty so that they can go and bury their loved ones, and so that they don't have to worry about anything other than, you know, trying to get over this tremendous loss.
But what prospects do you have of getting that kind of amnesty?
Well, the thing is that many people now are focusing on granting, like you said earlier, with Chuck Schumer ironing out a deal with the officials in the Dominican Republic. Many people are concentrating on giving visas to those that live in the Dominican Republic so they could come over here. I think that something that needs to be brought to light is the fact that many of the family members over here, you see, not only were the people on the plane the sole providers for their families here in the United States, as well as their family members in the Dominican Republic. In fact, many of those on the flight were going to the Dominican Republic to take back money so that their families could, you know, live well over in the Dominican Republic or as best they can. But they were also sponsors of the family members over here, some of them who are undocumented. They're illegal. Yesterday, we represented families of seven of the victims on the flight who want to go to the Dominican Republic but are afraid because they're not going to be let back in the country. And so right now, we have to bring this to light. I don't think that many people even had this type of issue on their minds. I mean, while they're worried about the family members coming from the Dominican Republic, many people were unaware of the fact that a lot of the members over here who want to go and bury their family members are scared to do so because they want to come back. So we're working not only to grant them emergency visas, but amnesty so that when they go to the Dominican Republic, they can let back. Let me just tell you about two different cases. One is a lady who had a living husband or boyfriend for 13 years. He was her sponsor. You know how when you sponsor someone to come from the Dominican Republic and come over, many people have sponsors over here. He was a primary sponsor. Now, had she been, for example, a legal resident here, she probably would have been on the flight. The only reason why she was not on the flight is because she is scared to travel because, you know, for fear of that, of not being let back in the country. Now, they have a 9-year-old daughter who is an American citizen. However, she no longer has a sponsor now. What is she to do? She wants to go and bury her husband, but she's afraid that she won't be let back over here. And she wants her daughter to be brought up in America. Her daughter is an American. Her daughter's in school over here. Her daughter's in the fourth grade. What is she to do? Another gentleman, his name is Emmanuel Rosa Santiago, who lost a brother on the flight. His brother is a citizen of the United States who lived out in Orlando, traveled up to New York just to spend a couple of days with Emmanuel, and he was flying to the Dominican Republic because next week is their mother's birthday. And their mother, who has cancer, there was like the whole family was having a big event for her birthday. Now, Emmanuel would have went, but again, he's also scared to fly for the fear of not being let back into the United States. And he needs to be over here to produce money, to work hard. He worked in a beauty salon shop, and he sends money to the Dominican Republic. But now his brother's gone. His mother fell into a coma yesterday, and he's really torn between staying here and waiting to see if the federal government is going to grant him some amnesty or risking it all and going over to the Dominican Republic because he needs to be by his mother's side now, and he needs to be the one to make all of the arrangements for his brother's burial when they do identify his brother's body.
We're talking to Ruben Diaz, New York State Assembly member for the Bronx, one of the outspoken advocates for New York's Dominican community. On Wednesday, held a news conference in New York calling for amnesty for people to be able to go back to the Dominican Republic to bury their dead or to come here to be able to identify the remains of those lost on the American Airlines flight that went down over the Rockaways in Queens earlier this week. This issue of dealing with the INS at a time like this, also in terms of World Trade Center, families that lost loved ones. We understand many are afraid to come forward for the very same reasons, afraid that with the police working closely with the INS, that if they don't have the proper papers, they could be deported. So they're afraid to name their loved ones who were lost in the World Trade Center. And then companies at the World Trade Center who could face sanctions for naming the list of undocumented workers they have, not putting those names forward. So not knowing names at the World Trade Center. Is this an issue you're dealing with?
Yeah, this has been an issue as well. And I think that INS and the federal government, again, Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer have worked strongly on this. They've been working closely with those people who are undocumented, and I think many more people now feel more comfortable of coming up and stepping up to the plate and reaping some of the benefits so that they can get compensated as best as possible for their loss. And we've been dealing with this. But again, in this particular issue, it's not just about stepping up and claiming a lost one. It's about traveling back to your homeland, burying your loved one, and being allowed back into the United States. And so we're hoping for the same type of response from INS, from the U.S. senators here in the state of New York, and from, you know, President Bush and the federal government.
But Assemblyman Diaz, you're talking about a time where President Bush has just announced these secret tribunals for, quote, non-Americans who could be tried with, out evidence being presented, et cetera. You're talking about a time of very serious repression, particularly for immigrants. So how do you expect this to take place?
We're very sensitive to that, and of course we don't want to advocate for anything that's gonna cause the security of the nation to be weakened. And so, but the reality is that this is a community, the Dominican community. The members here have been here for many years. Many of them have never gotten in trouble with the law, and this is I believe a special situation. We're not talking about granting this type of amnesty to everyone, just the families of the victims of Flight 587. And it's a very small amount of family members. I mean, yesterday we had seven families of seven of those victims. And so we're hoping that, you know, something could happen in this particular case.
Are you concerned about Attorney General John Ashcroft saying, quote, if you overstay your visa by a day, we will arrest you?
No, I think that, you know, I'm not going to second guess the Attorney General. I think that, you know, this is all now due to heightened security, of course, because of what happened at the World Trade Center. Again, we're talking about a very specific case where individuals lost their families so tragically and so suddenly, and for us to you know, target them, I think we'll be adding insult to injury in this particular case. Again, we're not trying to second guess the Attorney General. We're not trying to, you know, weaken the security of this nation. I think that this is a very specific case that we should be extra sensitive to.
I want to thank you very much, Ruben Diaz, for being with us, New York State Assembly member from the Bronx, representing the Dominican families who lost loved ones on American Flight 587 that went down on Monday in the Rockaway section of Queens. It's believed 265 people died. You're listening to The War and Peace Report. When we come back, an organizer talks about how to speak out in a time when dissent is cracked down on. And then Peter Coyote, the actor, will read from a brochure, Know Your Rights. Stay with us.
Life is one big road with lots of signs. So when you're riding through the ruts, don't you complicate your mind.
Wake Up and Live, Bob Marley and the Wailers, Survival, here on the War and Peace Report, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Since September 11th, teachers, students, activists around the country have been targeted for speaking out against the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Among the latest examples is a report from the Conservative American Council of Trustees and Alumni that lists more than 100 students and professors who've spoken out as examples of un-American activity. That report from the group that is founded by Liz Cheney, the wife of the current Vice President Dick Cheney. While this crackdown on dissent has not prevented people from speaking out against racial profiling or from organizing against war, it certainly sparked a debate about what activists can do. During the meeting of the World Trade Organization this past week, people gathered in New York to strategize about organizing against war and corporate globalization. In fact, many people are headed up to Ottawa for this weekend's G20 meeting who are planning to protest. One of the speakers this past weekend in New York at the U.S. Strategy Summit organized by New York's Anti-War Coalition in Manhattan was Cindy Milstein from the Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont.
I think it's interesting today that many of us went out and did the solidarity action for the WTO meeting, because in a sense today really brackets from Seattle to September 11th as this historical moment where there was this opening up of space for voices like most of us who never get heard, who don't get interviewed on NPR or aren't interviewed by our local paper, who barely exist in society because our voices really aren't heard. Sometimes you think you're going a little crazy because the world never reflects back your values, even though you know your values are good. And so what was most astonishing to me over the past 2 years is it opened up a space for an anti-authoritarian left in this country like hasn't been seen perhaps ever, or at least for a long time. And some of the parameters of that for me are that it was talking about people not looking to the state, not looking to capitalism, not looking to other forms of domination to demand things from or to ask things of, but was asking for all of us again to take control to shape our lives again, perhaps one of the first times, something that happens in moments of revolution where people demand popular control of their society together to shape their society. And what was powerful to me about this space was suddenly where people were saying, this is what democracy should look like. It should look like all of us being thoroughly capable of deciding what our world looks like. So suddenly direct democracy was counterposed to the democracy that is offered us as representative democracy. And people really questioned the whole need for nation states, I think, in this movement. Suddenly, the question of capitalism was exposed and discussed. And I love watching mainstream media outside the United States, because it would always call the movement going on here the anti-capitalist movement, where the American media was very hesitant to use those words. But it really was questioning, do we need a way of producing and distributing and feeding and clothing and housing and providing for our desires that's based on money, exploitation, coercion, making us do things we want to do, or should we have something that's completely different than capitalism? So really what this movement to me has been talking about was, how do we want to live as free, highly individuated individuals in a free and highly communal society at the same time? And suddenly September 11th comes, and it's as if that space, which I think we kept widening and widening and widening the parameters of, just went like that. And it was suddenly like we were totally silenced and lost again, but more painfully so, because we'd actually had a space in society. So I understand September 11th as a horrible, horrible, horrible day that did many things, including collectively sort of silence everyone, but most of all silence sort of us in a way for good, many of us thought, is like, how can we find a space again? And I think for those of us on the anti-authoritarian left, the silence was in a way healthy, because I think it's really difficult to understand what is going on. What is globalization? What is this thing we've been opposing? And for my mind, what September 11th did was not change the world so much, although certainly many things have changed, but almost sped up in fast forward motion processes of globalization that we couldn't even understand before September 11th. And now we're as if we've like fast forwarded 10 years in advance. We're facing all sorts of things, to name one thing, the dismantling of civil liberties, that they were doing anyway, as I agree with what's said here before, but probably would have taken them 5, 10, 15 years. Now suddenly in a day, you know, there's this huge new, you know, dismembering of civil liberties. But a host of other things, a new supra world police state, in a sense, which they've slowly been doing. It's not like they haven't been sharing information on us around the world. The FBI went over to Prague to help advise on those of us who'd been at demonstrations here to keep an eye out for us at the borders. They've been doing all this stuff, but suddenly they're doing it to such a degree that, you know, the world feels much more difficult to figure out where to engage with politically. But to me, all this points out is the imperative more than ever that our voices are necessary, that critique of statecraft, that critique of capitalism, critique of domination, of racism, is more needed than ever. And I think what this moment of silence, the possibility I find in this moment of silence for us, being stunned by the new world, in a sense, we face, is that it's the same world we didn't understand before. And I think for most of us, we need it was healthy for us to realize we need to be able to understand this world better and explain it to people better, to figure out what's going on. Because if we don't even understand what's going on, I think we're going to be left over with phrases that we've been using from the past to try to protest or try to realize a better society. So for instance, to me, and I completely agree that ultimately what globalization is about a shift in where power lies. Where is power being consolidated? And I think we're so used to thinking of the United States as the superpower that can basically do what it wants in the world without regard for anyone or anything else. And certainly, I'm not arguing the United States isn't pretty much still the superpower, but I think there's cracks in that which could go, in a sense, in many directions. And one of the directions many of us were opposing on the streets was going in the direction of even higher combinations, in a sense, of more consolidations of power, where perhaps the nation state was breaking down a little bit, but it was forming alliances to create regional blocks. So perhaps in 15 or 20 years, not only would we see the United States in the borders that we do now, but perhaps we'd see a new configuration of power from the whole Americas down, fighting a whole configuration of power from, you know, the European continent down to the Asian continent down. And so we're facing new, more consolidated forms of power that I think are just beginning to solidify, which is why I think in the past the United States would have bombed within a day or two. And I think we need to ask ourselves, why did they wait? Why are they so concerned about forming this alliance? Why are they concerned about keeping other people in line? I don't think it's because they're nice or they're worried about what other people think. I think it's because, in a sense, it's a little chipping away of what the United States' power was, totally tiny little bits. But we need to project ahead and say, where is this leading us? What new, uglier world might we be seeing when you have even more consolidated blocks of power? But at the same time, we're facing really consolidated super-statist powers with people that are willing to fly planes into the World Trade Center that are non-statist, but they're not the non-statist many of us in the anti-authoritarian left are talking about. They have a really ugly authoritarian version of what a non-statist society would be like. So for those of us that have been saying you can't necessarily look to the state for the answers, we have to be much, much, much more clear about what we stand for. So for me, the opening this gives us, well, the first possibility for politics right now is the healthy stepping back for us to try to re-examine, is this imperialism or is this something new? Is this the United States as superpower or something new? What does it mean when we have not only a police state in the United States, but a world police state? Where should law, legal questions reside? In embedded in cultures or in a world court that is, in a sense, outside any parameters of control? Now, certainly I think it would be better if a bin Laden was brought before a Hague tribunal for crimes of genocide right now. But is that really the longer term answer many of us are seeking, where you have further consolidations of power? So the opening is for us to look internally and come to things like this and teach-ins and examine our own assumptions before we just go out with the same old slogans that we've had in the past. And I think it's good for us to take that downtime in a way to think through our own positions. But on the other hand, I think the other part of this has been, in a sense, an opening. I'm trying to temper my pessimism because I think this is about the worst time to do activism. But I think the some of the other, in a sense, openings that we can find is that because we are living inside the process of globalization, we are not at the end of it. It's hard to see outside that. And so what we see are weird paradoxes that almost are not understandable. And so right now, because in a global world, people generally look outside their you know, insular borders. And you know, Americans have been particularly bad about this. But right now, there's been a tremendous amount of flag buying. But the two other things that have sold well, if you listen to, you know, the marketplace news or read Wall Street Journal, I think it's intriguing to read it because they actually explain what the hell's really going on, because they want to make sure capitalism continues. The other two things that have sold really well are maps of the world and books on Islam, on, you know, explaining Middle Eastern culture, politics. Now, I think we could look at the pessimistic side and be upset about all the flags waving, certainly. But in a sense, the possibility lies in that there's a sense of openness, that people are willing to look outside these borders of the United States for a change, to try to understand the world. They want to understand the world in the way they never have, I think. And that gives us a possibility to speak to people in ways we haven't, to create forums for education about the world, because people are seeking that out. And, you know, Giuliani telling people to take off, I thought that was very funny, take the day off from work and go shopping. I was like, who's selling things if everybody's taking the day off from work? But but it's interesting that people really haven't shopped as much. They've really, I mean, they still continue to shop, of course, but in a sense, they've wanted to understand what's going on. And so not only have they been seeking the products of maps and books, but they've been seeking out a sense of meaning and a sense of value. And from being an outsider to New York City, I think maybe more than any place, maybe people have done that here, because it's more incomprehensible here because you're living it, you're experiencing it. Many of you know people or you know, pass through that area or work there, and so have even a more intimate feeling with that. But there's people in, like, huge, I'm terrible at remembering statistics, but something like 25 or 40% of Americans now are going to, you know, church again when they weren't before, or are spending more time with their families, or, you know, all these things are questioning, are asking ethical questions. And that's, regardless of, we may not want everyone to turn to religion, but I think turning to religion is perhaps a better step to seek out meaning, to seek out value, than turning to the shopping mall. And so we have to take you know, in a sense, I think what's been most important about the anti-authoritarian left is it's spoken in richly ethical terms. It hasn't often been pragmatic, and good, because the terms of the debate always give you two or three or four bad choices. And if you're pragmatic, you'll never be utopian. You'll never look to a better world. And if nobody's asking for a better world, I don't know how we're going to get there, because there's never the idea of it even out there to move toward. So therefore, while people are looking for values, meaning, is there more to something than going to Wall Street every day and working? I think we need to be there to keep our values and our ethics forward. And for those of us, many of us, that might mean things like solidarity or mutual aid. We could think about cooperation, relationships outside of coercion, hierarchy, domination. And I think this is a moment where if we are lead with our ethics instead of trying to pragmatically think, well, should we go to the UN or should we ask the United States to do this or should we, in a sense, I would almost say we should continue not to ask the pragmatic questions in our politics. We should continue to put forward not just a critique, but a vision.
You're listening to Cindy Milstein. The Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont is her organization. She was speaking at a U.S. strategy summit organized by the New York Anti-War Coalition in Manhattan on Friday night. And we're going to go back to that speech and then move on to Peter Coyote reading a pamphlet on knowing your rights. We're back to Cindy Milstein.
Call for all sorts of things, but we don't do anything. You know, we don't do enough for tangibly for people. And I think this gives us a chance to model the kind of world we want to see in ways that are outside of the parameters of what George Bush tells us to do or, you know, Bin Laden would tell us to do. So people of Afghanistan, for instance, have been starving for many years because of war and authoritarian regimes. And now they are starving again because of another authoritarian regime coming in and bombing them. So what would an anti-authoritarian response be to that, that actually provides people with something of substance? And one of the most appalling things since September 11th to me was when I listened to George Bush's speech that night, whichever his major address to the nation was, and at the very end he made that little pitch, all children of America, please send me a dollar to send to the children of Afghanistan. I thought that was horrible. They want every kid in America to raise a buck, wash a car, you know, take a dog for a walk, mow a lawn, send me your dollars, and you know, so we can send some food to those people we're bombing. But at the same time, those people were already starving in that country because of the processes of structural adjustment, the same institutions we've been opposing, because of authoritarian regime in their own country, and now because of the nation state we live under. So in a way, I think it'd behoove us to say, what would humanitarian aid look like outside of, you know, centralized states, centralized NGOs, centralized, authoritarian regimes all over the world? In a way, what would a material aid campaign look like from us that didn't work in those parameters? And in a way, I think it'd be really interesting for us to start building structures of how would we, and really try to do it, how would we provide for people who are going to be hungry around the world? How would we continue to build the links we've been making globally with people on other continents to help respond to global crises such as hunger? And I think that's been actually tangible we could do. And we may not be able to directly take food over there, but I think we could actually work with some of the people we've been building the alliances with through this globalized movement to create a humanitarian network. And even if it's piddling as dropping those stupid yellow packages that they're dropping of foodstuffs, even if all we got was that amount of food over there, because we would have done it in a directly democratic, confederated, mutual aid kind of network, I think it would be a model of how we might want people to respond in the future to crises like drought and hunger. And similarly, I think we can offer, as we've been doing at demonstrations, the same sort of, mutual aid, voluntaristic legal aid we've been doing to people in this country who are going to be experiencing racism, being thrown in prison because of the color of their skin, because of their religious beliefs. We could provide a non-statist form of legal aid to people, like we've been doing at demonstrations, but expand on that to show here's how we would want people to be, dealt with when there's conflict in the short term before we reach our utopian vision of never having people because of their skin color being thrown into jail. So I guess I'll just end on the note that I think we have to just, for me it's a very difficult time because it's hard not to feel pessimistic and fearful all the time, but I think we have to try to find those innovative moments where we can put out something that's different and utopian to give people a vision. Because, after September 11th, everyone kept saying, well, the anti-globalization movement or anti-capitalist movement or the anti-authoritarian left, shouldn't say anything because it's really inappropriate. They should stop. But capitalism didn't stop. Nation states hasn't stopped. Racism hasn't stopped. Sexism hasn't stopped. We can go through the long list of forms of domination that have not only not stopped, they've gotten a lot stronger. And therefore, I think we need to, more than ever, we have the moral imperative as people on an anti-authoritarian left to not stop also.
Cindy Milstein, the Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont, speaking in New York this past weekend. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we return, we'll go to actor Peter Coyote talking about knowing your rights. Stay with us.
Running around here like you was God. Then they wonder why the shooting starts. Getting checks with half my stacks. I forgot George Bush wrote half my raps. Murdering people for blasting facts. They're blaming other cats for their trashy acts. I'm trying to get paid till my eyes is closed. And cops is like freeze, and I'm already frozen. So they clapping, they brawling the stereo. Tapping Jackson, calling the Sevier. Green got cats crawling the barrier. Don't blame Kane for the fall of America.
This is not America. This is not America.
No, no, no.
This is not America.
American dream.
This is not America.
Yo, run about these streets here before y'all creep here. Look around, we here. 365 days a year. Lines to cross, no fear. And what appears to be roses. See, I'm knowing this when I chose this. What's right? In broad day or night, more dope deals. I'm trying to stay on my heels. Every day's training day. Some things not in explaining ways. Who said crime don't pay? Choices to make. Ain't too many chances left to take. Things look so green. The sign of the times. Corruption, politics, young ones dying. What you made of? Either hate or love. Pressure on now when the push come to shove here.
This is not America.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Since September 11th, the Bush administration has launched an unprecedented assault on the rights of immigrants. In the last few days, the Bush administration issued an executive order to create special military tribunals to try people Bush says are terrorists. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced the Justice Department has compiled a list of 5,000 people, almost young, all men from Middle Eastern countries that it wants to voluntarily submit for questioning. Actor Peter Coyote recently read a brochure of the National Lawyers Guild called Knowing Your Rights.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas once reminded a group of young lawyers that the guarantees of the Bill of Rights are, quote, not self-executing. We have to continually make them work. As nightfall does not come all at once, Douglas added, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged. And it is in such twilight that we all must be most aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of darkness. Close quote. In order for the Bill of Rights to work for all of us, we need to know our rights. What rights do you have? You have the right to advocate for change. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protects the rights of groups and individuals who peacefully advocate changes in laws, government practices, and even the form of government. You have the right to remain silent. The Fifth Amendment of the Constitution gives every person the right to remain silent in the face of questions posed by any police officer or government agent. You have the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. The Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect our privacy. Without a warrant, government agents are not allowed to search your home or office, and you can refuse to let them in. Know, however, that it is easy for the government to monitor your telephone calls, conversations in your office, home, car, or meeting place, as well as mail. Email is particularly insecure. The government has already begun stepping up its monitoring of emails. Constitutional rights cannot be suspended, even during a state of emergency or wartime. What should you do if agents call you or come to your door to question you? 1. You do not have to talk to the police, FBI, INS, or any other law enforcement agent or investigator. Other than providing your name and address to a police officer who's investigating a crime, you are not legally obligated to talk to anyone on the street, at your home or office, if you've been arrested, or even if you're in jail. If you're driving a motor vehicle, you are required to show your license and registration. Only a judge has the legal authority to order you to answer questions. 2. You do not have to let police or other law enforcement agents into your home or office unless they have a search warrant or arrest warrant. Demand to see the warrant. A search warrant must specifically describe the place to be searched and the things to be seized. If they have a search warrant, you cannot stop them from entering and searching, but you should still tell them that you do not consent to a search. This will limit them to the scope of the search authorized by the warrant. An arrest warrant does not allow them to search your home or office unless you consent to it. Say, "I do not consent to a search," loudly and clearly. Consider having the person named on an arrest warrant go outside rather than letting the police into your home or office. 3. If they do present a search warrant, you have the right to monitor their search activities. You have the right to observe what they do. You have the right to ask them for their names and titles. Take written notes, including their names, badge numbers, and what agency they are from. Have your friends who are present act as witnesses. Give this information to your lawyer. A search warrant does not obligate you to answer questions. Do not give them permission to enter any part of your home or office, but remember that actually interfering with the search is unlikely to stop the search and likely to result in your arrest. This is true even if the search is not legal. 4. If the police or FBI or INS or anyone else tries to enter your home without a warrant, say no. Police and other law enforcement agents are very skilled at getting information from people. Many people are afraid that if they refuse to cooperate, it will appear as if they have something to hide. Don't be fooled. The police are allowed to, and do, lie to you. Although agents may seem nice and pretend to be on your side, they are often seeking information about the habits, opinions, and affiliations of people not suspected of wrongdoing, with the end goal of suppressing political activity that the government disagrees with. Trying to answer agents' questions or trying to educate them about your cause can be very dangerous. You can never tell how a seemingly harmless bit of information that you give them might be used and misconstrued to hurt you or someone else. And keep in mind that lying to a federal agent is a crime. The safest things to say are, "I am going to remain silent," "I want to speak to my lawyer," and "I do not consent to a search." 5. If you are stopped on the street, ask if you are free to go. If you are stopped by the police, ask them why. Remember that their answers may not be truthful because they are allowed to lie to you. Ask, "Am I free to go?" If they say yes, then tell them that you do not want to talk to them and that you are going to walk away. Then do so. If they answer no, then you are being detained. Being detained does not necessarily mean you will be arrested. They are entitled to frisk you. A frisk is a pat down on the outside of your clothing. If they search any further than this, say clearly, "I do not consent to a search." They may continue anyway. You do not need to answer any questions if you are detained or even if you are arrested. 6. Anything you say to the police, FBI, INS, etc., can be used against you and others. Once you've been arrested, you cannot talk your way out of it. Don't try to engage the police in dialogue or respond to their accusations. Remember that it is common for them to tell you things that are not true in order to get you to talk to them. They may pressure you by saying it's unpatriotic not to answer, or that people with nothing to hide would talk. Remember, however, that even innocent people who have done nothing wrong may say things that the government will use against them or other people. This is why the right not to talk is a fundamental right. Lying to the government is a criminal offense, so whatever you do, do not lie. Repeat, "I want to talk to my lawyer," to any officer that questions you. 7. If you are nervous about simply refusing to talk, tell them to contact your lawyer. They should stop trying to question you once you announce your desire to consult a lawyer. You do not need to already have one. Remember to get the name, agency, and telephone number of any investigator who visits you, and contact the National Lawyers Guild for help getting a lawyer. What is a subpoena? A subpoena is an order from a judge requiring a witness to come to court to testify. A grand jury subpoena requires someone to testify in front of a grand jury, the body that decides whether or not to proceed against someone who has been charged with a crime. Receiving a subpoena does not mean that you are suspected of a crime. It does mean that someone else has been charged with a crime and that they believe you have some relevant information. If you receive a subpoena, contact a lawyer. It is common for police to threaten you with a subpoena in order to get you to talk to them. Don't be intimidated by this, because even if it does happen, you're better off talking to the court after a subpoena has been issued than talking to any law enforcement officer without one. What is a material witness warrant? A material witness is a person believed to have information that is important to the outcome of a case. Usually, a witness is issued a subpoena requiring them to testify in a court. A material witness warrant is issued when there is reason to believe that the witness will not comply with a subpoena. An example of this is if the judge believes that the person may hide from the police or leave the country. This type of warrant allows the potential witness to be held in jail, even though he or she has not been charged with a crime. Even a material witness warrant does not require you to talk to a law enforcement agent. If you are being threatened with a material witness warrant, contact a lawyer. What if I am not a citizen? The most important thing to do is carry with you at all times the name and number of an attorney who will take your calls. If you are a legal permanent resident, you should carry your green card as well. Navigating the immigration system by yourself is extremely difficult. Congress is considering new laws that will give INS extra power to swiftly deport people it thinks are terrorists. There are also many laws on the books that INS could decide to use against people it wishes to arrest or detain. As soon as you encounter an INS agent, call your attorney. If you can't do it right away, keep trying. You must assert these rights. The INS will not do it for you. If you do not demand these rights, or if you sign documents waiving your rights, the INS may deport you before you see either an attorney or a judge. 1. As a non-citizen, you have rights. Know and assert them. Based on existing laws, regulations, and INS guidelines, non-citizens generally have the following rights, regardless of your immigration status. You have the right to speak to an attorney before answering any questions or signing any documents. You have the right to call an attorney or your family if you are detained, and you have the right to be visited by an attorney in detention. You have the right to have your attorney with you at immigration hearings with the INS. You do not, however, have the right to a government-appointed attorney, so you must hire one or contact the National Lawyers Guild for help finding one who will represent you for free. If you are arrested or detained, the INS must decide in 48 hours whether to put you into immigration proceedings and whether to keep you in custody or to release you on bond. You have the right to request release from detention even if the INS hasn't said why it wants to deport you. In most cases, you have the right to request release from detention by paying a bond if necessary, or to request a bond hearing before an immigration judge, even if you have not been formally charged with an immigration violation. In most cases, you have the right to a hearing before an immigration judge to determine whether you have violated the immigration laws. Talk to an immigration lawyer before leaving the U.S. Non-citizens may be barred from coming back to the U.S. if they fall into certain categories. And in general, always try to consult with an attorney before talking to the INS, even on the phone. Many INS officers view enforcement, meaning deporting people, as their primary job. They do not believe that explaining immigration options is part of their job, and most will readily admit this. Non-citizens who are victims of domestic abuse should speak with an expert in both immigration law and domestic violence. You do not have to reveal your immigration status. If you have legal immigration status, you may wish to explain this to an INS agent. The questioning may end at this point, but if the INS asks anything about your political views, organizations you belong to, things you have said, where you have traveled, or other questions that seem inappropriate, you do not have to answer them. If you are a foreign national arrested in the U.S., you have the right to call your consulate or to have the police inform the consulate of your arrest. The police must allow your consul to visit or speak with you. Your consul might assist you in finding a lawyer or offer other help, such as contacting your family. You also have the right to refuse help from your consulate. In America, in times of national crisis and in times of war, the Bill of Rights and the civil liberties of people seeking peace and justice are often sacrificed on the altar of national security. Remember, constitutional rights cannot be suspended even during a state of emergency or during wartime. For more information, call the National Lawyers Guild, 415-285-1055, or visit their website at www.nlg.org. To report hate crimes, call the American Civil Liberties Union Hate Crimes Hotline at 415-621-2493, extension 322, or call the Arab and Muslim Community Toll-Free Hotline at 1-877-282-2288. Arabic speakers are available. For further information, contact the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, 202-244-2990, or visit their website at www.adc.org. My name is Peter Coyote, and you are listening to KPFA 94.1, the home of free speech radio. Know Your Rights is a guide created by the National Lawyers Guild and brought to you by KPFA Radio. It is also available in print, in Arabic, and in Farsi.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get more information on a video of today's hour, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921, or visit our website at democracynow.org. Look forward to seeing listeners in Troy, New York at WRPI on Friday night, and at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., Columbia Road and 16th at 6 o'clock on Saturday after the National Board Meeting of Pacifica. Democracy Now! In Exile, produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the band and the fired, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Life is one big road with lots of signs. So when you're riding through the ruts, don't you complicate your mind. Vision.